The February 7th meeting of Labor and Commerce will begin at 3:04. With us today, we have Representative Book, Representative Gardner, Representative Gatto, and myself, Representative Olson. Today, we're going to hear from the Division of Insurance, and first up is Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. Good afternoon, Ms. Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for asking me to be here today. I always enjoy an opportunity to talk about what we do in the Division of Insurance. I have in your packets today way more material than you probably ever wanted. However, there are four pages of material. I promise I won't read it to you, but I'd like to go through just to give you an overview of the types of things that we do in the Division of Insurance. And what I will do as I go through that is kind of supplement with examples. I would strongly encourage you to ask questions if you have them as I go through this. But my goal today is to give you like an overview of what we do, the kinds of issues we deal with. I'm sure that there are issues that you hear from constituents. And so whatever I can do to help you understand how we function and the kinds of things we do, I'd be more than happy to do that.
Ms. Hall, I'd like to interrupt you briefly to introduce Representative Mark Newman, who's joined us. All yours.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
At the beginning of the page, there's some general background that basically talks about what we do. Division of Insurance is the primary regulator of the insurance industry in Alaska. The federal government defers to the states in most areas of the regulation of insurance. So each of the states is a primary regulator in their own state of insurance companies that are, so to speak, domiciled is the term we use, but who are headquartered in their state. The division is accredited by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. It's a national group of regulators that meet and work together to share information to come up with joint goals. Mission of the division, and I am going to read this piece to you, is to protect and educate the consumer, to develop, interpret, and enforce insurance statutes and regulations, and to enhance the insurance business environment. As I talk, I'd like to keep that in mind. We have very diverse goals, and it's sometimes a very delicate balancing act, where we're doing consumer protection, but we also need to make sure that we're keeping an atmosphere and environment that provides a competitive marketplace. Without a competitive marketplace, our consumers have no choice. We want to make sure there are choices of providers, and in a state our size, that sometimes is a challenge. There are actually seven sections in the division, each with very unique responsibilities. The first and probably the one you may hear about the most at times from your constituents is our consumer services section. This is the group of people, and there are four people in this section, who respond to consumer complaints. We have a number of kinds of complaints that we deal with on a regular basis. And to give you some general idea, we take consumer complaints, and our first step is normally to take that complaint and go back to the insurance company and ask them for their files, ask them for a response. We do things as diverse as health insurance, and probably in excess of half of the complaints we get are about health insurance. Recently, we had a very successful outcome with a complaint where we had an individual who had been turned down for an investigative surgery, and through the work of the head of our section, that ultimately was approved. We recently had an auto insurance complaint where an insurance company had not provided the consumer with the things that are required under regulations. We call them comparable qualified comparisons. Often we get companies where if you total your car, the comparison you get is from a Seattle auto dealer. That does not meet our regulations. So in this case, we went back to the company and reminded them of their responsibility under our claims regulations. And they did fulfill that. But those are the kinds of things that we do.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gatto.
I'd like to ask a question on that very subject. If indeed the insurance company says, I want to find out the value of your car, and they go to the for sale ads. They are essentially finding out the value of a car that somebody wants to sell. The owner didn't want to sell it. He wanted to keep it, or he would have put it in the ads to sell it. So if the insurance company says, well, we determine the value of your car by picking the cheapest car that's like your car that was for sale by a person who didn't want the car, and we're going to appraise that and say that's the value of your car, and then we're going to take 85% of that, and that's what we think your car was worth. That's a true story. Are you aware that that's the procedures that insurance companies are using on clients and on other insured individuals?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, not if I can help it. I am aware of it, but if we can intervene in that. But we also recognize that the replacement cost is an actual cash value. So someone with a vehicle they may not have wanted to sell will in all likelihood be looking for, to them it may have more value than the true, what we would call actual cash value. So it's not the fact that they didn't want to sell it, but what it can be replaced for. And it, our statutes regulations require that it be replaced by a local dealer so that you could get it today. If you live in King Salmon, for example, you would have some fairly extensive transportation expenses, those kinds of things. If you have to do new license plates, those kinds of things are added into that.
Correct.
But I think that it probably, when we talk about actual cash value, the example you gave may not violate our regulations. But we're always interested in looking at those if there's a problem with a claim settlement.
If I can continue, I guess to me the true value is to find a car from somebody who doesn't want to sell it and then say, okay, but if you did, what is it worth? Because that's the car I would want to buy from a guy who didn't want to sell it, not from somebody who's got one advertised and then find, of all the ones I've checked in the newspapers, the cheapest one and then reduce that one by a certain percent and say, you know that car you just lost? I'm making it equivalent, even though you didn't want to sell it, to the one that's discounted, the lowest price, and then further discounted. And that is the practice that insurance companies use. And if we object to that practice, then I guess we should contact you.
Through the chair, yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ms. Hall, I'm going to interrupt you again to introduce two committee members that have joined us. We have a full committee now, Representative Ledoux and Representative Ramirez. So we've got a full deck right now.
Okay, thank you. One of the things that I am very proud of as you look at the last statement under the Consumer Services section is the fact that in 2005, it's the most recent year we have complete numbers, the efforts of the Consumer Services section have resulted in an additional payment of benefits of $610,000, where we have gotten involved in complaints and have helped a consumer get additional monies from insurance companies. I would emphasize that we don't provide legal advice. We don't negotiate settlements. Sometimes there is some confusion about that role. The licensing section, again, it sometimes surprises people. The number of licensees we have, these are people who are eligible to sell insurance in our state. They are not insurance companies. We issue licenses based on a criteria that the individual is competent, trustworthy, and qualified. Qualified means they have passed a test. And we today have over 25,000 licensees. It's astonishing to me in a state this size. 3,750 of those are residents. Over 21,000 of those are non-residents. So we have a lot of people who are eligible to sell insurance products in our state. We regulate those. We also have sometimes license violations.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair. Linda, I'm just going to portray to you another drawing back on some life's experiences. During the Big Lake fire, there was a good friend of mine lost his home. The insurance company that he had, or that the broker had sold him, through insurance to this individual company. They just flat refused to pay. They said, well, we're not going to pay. Or we're not going to pay what you want. We're going to pay at a very reduced rate. I mean, it wasn't even reasonable by any means at all. It took him months, which put him way behind schedule in building his home. I mean, a tremendous burden on this man and his family. When he contacted the State Division of Insurance, there was a tremendous amount of problem, and your hands were somewhat tied, I believe, looking at, you know, I know a little more about what you do now. But this license had several complaints from the small business administrations around the state, although they weren't a member of the Small Business Association, so there was no enforceability there. But several complaints about them and their practices, but they were allowed to sell insurance in the state of Alaska. I guess my question comes down to, what assurances do we have as citizens for the citizens of the state of Alaska that the insurance companies that are selling insurance that people can purchase for their homes, for their life, for their auto, that those companies aren't going to say, oh, we don't want to deal with you? Because there was virtually no recourse to do besides to take them and try and go to court to sue, and they have a lot more money than he had. And there was nothing, it seemed like it was just, there was nothing that the Division of Insurance could really do about it. Can you?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I'm puzzled that there wasn't, because there are a number of statutory sanctions, so to speak. Obviously, without knowing the details, it's difficult for me to respond. But there are a number of sanctions that can be taken against insurance companies, up to probably the most severe, which is to terminate, to revoke their certificate of authority to do business in the state. I mean, that would be the most extreme. We have ability to fine for violations of our statutes. I'm having a hard time thinking
and this is what, you know, in discussions that I had with him, so I'm sorry, Linda.
Oh, that's quite all right. And as I talk about a couple other sections here, I will mention some of those things, but I would be hard-pressed to think there was a situation that the division's hands were tied.
Well, so, and excuse me, Linda, but you said that, you know, to the far extreme, you can sanction them so that they can't sell in the state of Alaska. They said, so what?
Well, that's true. They don't want to. There are statutory fines also, however, and those are due, and that would affect their licenses in other states. If we actually fine them, and we have certainly fined insurance companies, and if we fine them and they chose not to pay that fine, those actions go back through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, where it would then affect their ability to sell in other states.
Just to wrap this up, has that ever happened?
I don't know. I know the fines certainly have. I've never had anyone refuse to pay a fine.
Yeah.
And we have fined some in my tenure. Certainly what you're talking about was before my tenure, but I don't know that. But those actions against insurance companies are communicated on a regular basis.
So, well, it's good to hear in the last 10 years since you've been here, you've straightened that up.
I haven't been here for 10 years. It just seems that way. The next section is the investigation section. These are our predominantly criminal investigations. Insurance companies by statute are required to report suspected fraud to us. We are then, of course, supposed to investigate that suspected fraud, which we do. Give you examples of the kinds of fraudulent activities we see. Probably the most common one is that Sam Smith buys insurance at 4 o'clock. He actually had an accident at noon and didn't have insurance, and so he buys insurance, and funniest thing, oh, there was this accident. We get a lot of those. I mean, a surprising number to me. We sometimes have consumers who lose things that they haven't really lost. We are seeing today a practice of sales tactics that we are that are violating our statutes. We're in the process of doing two investigations right now on sales practices of annuities, and I will be talking about annuities a little later. We recently, probably the most recent investigation we're involved in is a mysterious fire. It's amazing things that burn down when there's not a lot of money coming into a business. We see fires frequently like that. Those are the kinds of things. We do both civil actions, administrative actions, and we have been there just about a year now. We have a dedicated criminal prosecutor who is still in the Department of Law but is assigned to us. Half of his job is criminal, half is civil. So we are working up front and having a better success rate with criminal prosecutions today than we had before. We actually had someone dedicated to working with us on that.
Representative LeBoux?
Where are you focusing most of your criminal prosecutions? Are they on claimant fraud or are they insurance company fraud?
We don't get a lot of insurance company fraud under our investigations for criminal activity. They're normally agent fraud and claimant fraud. Those are the most common ones. We have had some provider fraud that we've investigated in the medical arena where we have done provider fraud. We've had disability fraud. But normally the actions against insurance companies, I've not seen one that would go as far as being criminal. We'll do those under the market examination section where we have different types of penalties and, of course, in the financial examination. The fines that I've seen predominantly have come in the financial exams. So we don't see real criminal behavior at this point from insurance companies.
Representative Gatto?
Oh, she had a follow-up.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering where the line is between the civil fraud and the criminal fraud. Very often you'll find a case where someone has sued an insurance company for fraudulent practices and might get a verdict on it, but there won't be any criminal case. And I guess I'm kind of wondering why. I mean, if they're...
for fraudulent activities. Through the chair, Representative LeDoux, the suit that you speak of for fraudulent activities by an individual, I'm not aware that one of those has ever been brought to us again in the time I've been there, because we certainly would look at that. If there were a verdict of fraudulent activity, but I have not seen one of those come to us.
Representative Gatto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, let me just address this one. We have before us any number of people who are saying, oh, ethics is a serious issue before the legislature right now. And we know that you can be correct and still on the cutting edge of whether you're ethical or not. So let me explain how I got to that. If indeed you have an action that you're asking an insurance company to pay, and let's say it's a paltry $5,000, and you decide to go to small claims court, the insurance company has a right to say, I'm going to move this case to civil court. Well, that's devastating to a consumer because it would probably cost $30,000 to process the case with attorneys in civil court. So the insurance company is using a legal lever to not pay or simply to not even enter into the dispute on a claim. This is the question between whether it's ethical and whether it's legal. What they're doing is certainly legal. They can move it to civil court anytime they feel they'd like to, whether it's a nickel or whether it's $100,000. But doesn't it seem unethical to say, you're asking for $5,000 and I know how to pressure you into taking nothing?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, one of the pieces of the trade practices section of the insurance title actually says that insurance, that is a statutory violation. If an insurance company makes what, this obviously is not statutory language, makes a lowball offer in order to pressure a consumer into taking an offer by threatening to go to court, that does violate our statutes.
How interesting.
Representative LeDoux?
But wouldn't that only be the case of where it was a client of the insurance company and you're arguing over the, let's say you've got a homeowner's policy and there's a few thousand dollars worth of damage. What about the individual who perhaps is injured minorly in a car crash? Not enough to get a lawyer involved, but just wants to make a reasonable settlement. And let's say, you know, his medical bills have come to a few thousand dollars and he's lost a little bit of work. And so maybe it's a $5,000, a $6,000 case. And the insurance company offers him or her $1,000. And that person then takes it into court. And so then the insurance company, into small claims court. And then the insurance company then moves it into regular court. Or civil court, superior court, district court. That wouldn't be under the Unfair Trade Practices Act that you're talking about if it's a third-party claim rather than a client of the insurance company. Am I correct or am I not correct?
Through the chair, I can't answer that right now, Representative Ledoux. I do not recall that that is limited to first-party actions. But I will not, I don't want to answer that without being able to go back and look that statute up. I will be happy to research that and get back with you.
Thanks.
Sure.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair. Linda, I'm very intrigued as some of the questions from Representative Gatos and Representative Ledoux have come forth, because often we're contacted by constituents with different issues. And I'm not quite sure whether they're right or wrong, legal or illegal, but I notice in your investigation section here you talk a little bit about claimant fraud, license application issues, certainly workman's comp, agent fraud. Could you give us just so that I understand a little bit further, and I think we've got the time, Chair, to do this, but could you give us a brief example of what some of these different frauds are, what some of the most common ones are, so that I know what to react to or watch for when people talk to me about this?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the kinds of things I was talking about earlier were more claimant fraud, sales practices, broker fraud. Those are the kinds of things that we tend to investigate in our investigation section. When someone calls us, there's an evaluation made by the first contact, whether that's in our consumer services section or if it immediately goes to an investigator, of the section in the division that would best handle that. And there are so many kinds of either fraudulent activities that we see or complaints that maybe are not fraud, but that are someone doesn't feel that they have been treated fairly, or they didn't understand what the insurance they bought was. The next section on here, I'm going to talk more, I think, that may help also. What I would do is to encourage you, when you have a constituent, have them or you on their behalf or your staff refer them to us. I'm going to talk about our consumer complaint forms and what we get into, and I will tell you that the supervisor of that section said to me recently that the number of consumer complaints she's getting is down, and they're quite puzzled by that. So we're really looking. The consumer services section of the division is truly a consumer advocate. That's not really their role, but that's what they do, is they work with consumers to explain their insurance contracts, to help them figure out what they do or do not have as a complaint against an insurance company, and how to proceed with that. And if it then it goes from there to an investigation, or it can go into this next section. Another arm of the division is what's called our market conduct examination section. This is where we more likely focus on the practices and behaviors of insurance companies. We also do producers and brokers and adjusters. But this is where we actually will go in, and there are different levels, and look at how they're handling, for example, claims practices. And I'll give you a couple examples. I'd probably been in the division as a director for about a year, and we had started to get a number of complaints that, as I put it when I called the company, that were disproportionate to their market share. I mean, every company will have some complaints, and in our annual report, We show the number of complaints against different companies. But I actually called this company and said, look, we're getting a lot of complaints about the way you're handling claims. I would like you to come up here and sit down and talk to us and explain to us what you're doing, because something is wrong with what's happening in your claims office. The alternative to them coming up and sitting down and talking to us about that is that we send a market conduct examination team out at the company's expense. By statute, they pay for this examination, and we sit down and start going through claim files in their office. They really aren't thrilled with having us sitting down there in their office going through their files. In this particular case, this company came up from their out-of-state claims office, and by the time they came in and met with us, they had gone into their local claims office and realized they really did have a problem. Came in very apologetically, they made staff changes. Today, we rarely get a complaint from them. So that is one way we deal with claims practices. When we start to see consumer complaints, which is why I encourage consumers to call us, we can't know until we get the call that something is wrong out there. I had one of these meetings 2 weeks ago with a company, and we had had half a dozen complaints that were not the behavior we expect of a market to do business in Alaska. And we're going through that same process. But that's the first layer. We can then, as I said, go in with a market conduct team and look at claims practices. And there we then get into potential fines, certificate of authority, whatever it may be. But there are ways that we deal with that when we start to see complaints.
That's fine. Thank you, Linda. And I guess the bottom line is, if there's a question, ask it.
Exactly. I would say. When I talk about challenges and issues later, I'm going to talk about a couple very specific things where we've done market conduct. The next section of the division, again, very different. I would say one of our primary focuses is a financial examination of insurance companies. We have 1,072 admitted insurers in Alaska. We get financial reports on each of those that are reviewed. All of them are reviewed by a checklist. We have 9 that we are the primary regulator for. By statute, we do a thorough financial exam once every 3 years. Example, right now, we have a company that is headquartered in Alaska, although they write no business here, and they're actually physically located in New York. I have a team of financial examiners in New York as we speak, doing a financial exam, going through books, looking at the products they write, looking at their operations for this one particular company. It's one company in a large conglomerate, but we are the primary regulator of 9 companies. Other states depend on our financial reviews in order to feel comfortable that this, and this is why we're credited. We're credited based on the quality of our financial examinations. Our chief financial examiner has been with the division for 18 years. She's a CPA, has other designations, so we do a thorough financial examination. This financial exam section also collects premium taxes and fees, and that we'll talk about later, too.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm sorry to have to ask you to back up just a little bit to the market examination issues. We've been having sort of a dispute within my office and with some constituents, disputes, not quite the right word, about whether or not the health insurer, primarily that handles the state employees' plans, has an incentive to delay or deny claims processing. And we've met with Division of Retirement and Benefits, and they say that the contract actually has built-in incentives for them to reduce the number of complaints. But other people are saying that there's an incentive for them to delay as a cost benefit. Do you know anything about that, or would you have a position? Have you seen the contract?
Well, I haven't seen the contract through the chair, Representative Gardner. No, I haven't seen the contract. And what I would start out with is that of the people who have health insurance in Alaska, we actually only have oversight authority of about 40% of those individuals. So I'm going to start out by talking that, one, we do not assume regulatory responsibility for the state plan. Self-insured plans are regulated by the federal government under ERISA. So we don't have that primary regulatory authority. There are some other gray areas, but the oversight that we have does not extend to those companies. I can tell you we do get a number of complaints because certainly a consumer calling in doesn't know where else to go. And we try to help them as best we can. We also send them to retirement and benefits. Do I think there's a motivation or an incentive to delay payments? I frankly don't know in the situation where you're talking about what it would be. Because when you're talking about a self-insured plan, they're paying costs. The insurance administrator, even though it is actually an insurance company, they're functioning not as an insurance company, they're functioning as an administrator. Mm-hmm. They're paid a fee for the administration, so the dollar value of the claims really, I hate to say this will sound kind of trite, but it really is of no significance to them because that doesn't affect their own profit margins. I mean, that goes back to the state. And if there's no incentive in the state to cut the cost of claims, there shouldn't be an incentive to delay payment.
Hello?
Thank you. That was actually my understanding, talking with Division of Retirement Benefits, and yet there are various publications by retired associations, not the AARP, but they keep coming across things where people are skeptical and believe that there's a reason that they encounter these frustrations in claims processing, including a journalist who works in this building who thinks that there's something in the contract that gives them some incentive to keep costs down, and maybe what you're saying makes sense. Maybe the thing to do is try to look at the contract. Say thank you.
If I could interject, I believe they passed a copy out yesterday in one of the budget subcommittees, and it did have the penalties built in on responsiveness, on how fast they picked up the phone, how fast they got back to them, how fast they paid. And
All right.
Actually, the state is making money for slow activity, and they get penalized. The third-party administrator gets penalized on it, but I think I've got them in my office, and I can get them to you.
Thank you.
Representative Rammers.
Thank you. Madam Director, maybe you're going to get to this first. I'm very impressed with the job that you do. And the question I have for you is with regard to the resuscitation of the work comp industry.
I will get to that.
Are you going to get to that? And when you cover that, the reason why I paused now is because you were talking about auditing the financial strength of companies. And so if it's appropriate, then I'll defer. But I'm interested in the Fremont debacle. I posed a question in our overview in judiciary of the Department of Law whether there has been anybody to pursue with all the failures of the work comp companies some years ago, Fremont and whoever else failed. And so if you can incorporate that either into this part of your presentation or when you get to work comp, because I'm more interested in the health of the guarantee fund and any efforts to try and return premiums to those businesses that paid into that to make it solvent once again.
Through the chair, Representative Bramless, I have planned to address that later. Not that specific thing, but I certainly can.
Okay, great.
The best of my ability.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. The last section I want to talk about very briefly is the filing section. It has an impact on the things that we all hear from consumers about rates. And I'm not going to talk in this particular segment about work comp rates. I will do those later. This is a section that reviews insurance contracts and premium filings. I will tell you there are some statutory guidelines for rates. And they're very broad, they're very general, but it's that rates may not be excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory. Excessive rates means there's too much premium charge for losses that have taken place. This is an actuarial analysis where actual losses are provided to us, claims adjustment expenses, and other expenses. So we're not interested in rates being excessive. We're not interested in rates being inadequate, because then we will get into what Representative Ramos just talked about. If rates are not adequate, then we get into insolvencies. So there are two ends to that extreme. Unfairly discriminatory means that like risks get charged like premiums, so that you don't have one class of business that has multiple premium rates and they have the same kind of characteristics. I will tell you we have some consumer products here that I'd like to see more people get. One of them from a filing section is the Medicare supplement rates. We do an actual whole brochure on that. We have a 2006 Homeowners Insurance Guide and Auto Guide. These publications actually have samples of rates by company. I mean, I'm looking here at Bethel, and it lists 10 insurance companies, different types of houses, different construction, where a consumer can go in here and look at average prices, insurance companies who write in, this page happens to be Nome. So we do this for across the state. We do the same thing with automobiles. So when we have consumers who can't find insurance, these are very valuable kinds of documents, and frequently people don't know they exist.
Representative LeBeau.
When you were talking about discriminatory rates between different classes of people, I mean, if somebody owns a restaurant, for example, and a friend walks in, always give the friend a better rate. I'm going to assume that insurance companies don't have that sort of latitude, that they can't give specific people breaks. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative LeDoux, that's correct. Excuse me. That's correct. There are filings that insurance companies make that allow them for particular characteristics to charge a different price, but those need to be filed across the board. If you have a particular type of, I'm going to say, fire suppression system in a restaurant that's, I'm going to say, maybe above average versus an average one, you might get a credit for that. Those kinds of things, but those are filed with us. They're called schedule credit plans, and they have to be filed. In fact, we did an audit of a company last year looking at exactly that question to see if they actually were following their filed schedule credit rating plan. So there are ways to give breaks for particular things, but they're across the board.
Ms. Hall, this might be a good place to give us a brief update on credit scoring. Hate to sandbag you, but...
Thank you. Representative Gardner has a wonderful piece over here that I brought to her today. As we've had that discussion already during this session.
No, I was not aware of that, but
yeah, we're very prepared.
Oh,
sure. Do you want
Representative?
Thank you. I had another related question. You have the auto insurance guide, the homeowners insurance guide. You had a third one,
Medicare supplement guide.
Okay, and you don't have a health care insurance guide.
No, we don't.
Okay.
There are so few companies writing it there.
Right. I'd like to see
very
it.
Much room.
Representative Newman.
Thank you.
Linda, can I get copies of those, too?
Absolutely.
And you also said you had an annual report. Is that, if that's public information, I'd like to be able to
you
see
You should
that.
Have one. It was mailed to each of you.
About a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
I read it. It was compelling.
What was the best part?
Well, you know,
tell me one thing you remember from it. No, that was sorry, I take that back.
The pictures, Linda.
There aren't any pictures.
And the reason I asked that is because I've had clients call and I didn't know what to tell them. I thought it was somewhat, quite frankly, a ridiculous question, but now I realize it's not. They said, "How come?" I guess there's no such thing as a ridiculous question. They said, how come we don't have a list of what insurance agencies charge, you know, what all the insurance agencies charge for different things? And I said, well, it depends on your age, your driving record. I mean, there's so many different things out there, but there is a basic list of what is charged there.
Yeah. There are certainly a great number of variables when you deal with any kind of insurance, and that's why these are fatter than you might expect. So we can't cover all the variables there, but it gives people a good idea. This is with your materials, and you might want to take a look at this also. We redid this August of last year, and I have lots of these. We printed 5,000 of them, so anybody that wants multiple copies, we could do that. This is our consumer guide, and we have it online on our website. We mail them to anybody that asks. We mail one out with all of our responses to consumer complaints. This affects, again, personal insurance. It talks about homeowners. It talks about auto. It does talk about life insurance, health insurance, annuities. And it also includes a consumer complaint form and contact information. So I think this is probably, to me, it has definitions of terms. Insurance is confusing to most people. It's like a different language, and we try to help people understand what they have, give them things to watch for. I mean, this, I think, is probably one of the best consumer things we could do, and if you want some in your offices for your constituents that come to visit, I would be happy to supply those to you also. I mean, I think it's a very valuable guide. Last thing I would say about filings is that we have, in 2005, we received 4,750 rate and form filings. So this is there's a lot that goes into the review of the forms and the rates that insurance companies charge. Section on revenues, I've just put in there because I don't think people generally are aware of the amount of premium taxes that are paid by insurance companies into the state. The FY06 premium taxes are well in excess of $44 million. I think for the last 2 years, insurance premium taxes are the second largest source of revenue to the general fund. Obviously way, way, way behind oil. But it is a significant source of revenue. I periodically get comments that insurance companies don't pay income tax, they don't pay corporate taxes. Insurance companies pay premium taxes in lieu of those other kinds of taxes. In calendar year 2005, $2.7 billion of premiums of insurance were written in our state. It's a lot of money. So we're really talking about that.
Representative Ramirez,
on that point, Madam Director. And again, this is largely on the commercial side. $2.7 billion is a lot relative to the GDP of the state of Alaska. On the other hand, in the same way that we can't attract enough doctors to practice medicine, are you satisfied, to practice medicine in Alaska, are you satisfied with the volume of commercial carriers that we have here in Alaska to provide for as competitive a market as one might find in the lower 48 for commercial coverage? Because I found the market to be the universe of what Alaska National writes, and not much broader than that, although other companies nickel and dime into the state of Alaska. I don't find that there's a lot of a breadth of companies that write here. Can you expound on that, please?
Absolutely. Am I satisfied? Absolutely not. One of the things I'll talk about is regulatory modernization and efforts to bring markets into our state. And I am seeing little bits of glimmer. It's a big process. And there has to be enough premium volume to make it worthwhile. Alaska's longer distance. They don't understand some of the particular unique qualities of our state. So it is difficult, but I will tell you as I go through my issues and challenges piece that I am seeing some improvements there.
Okay.
Not enough to make me jump up and down for joy, but I'm pleased to see some beginnings. The last piece under the revenues that I would mention are the division in FY06 generated $9.6 million in fees. Division of Insurance is funded by fees of those we regulate. We are not funded through the general fund. So it is somewhat different than many of the other divisions throughout state government. You'll note under my issues and challenges second, it's markets. That's the first thing, and I think Representative Ramirez, you referred to that. I'm not satisfied with it, and I have been trying to work. Generally, contrary to popular opinion, no insurance company wants to write all of the business in a state. Most of them typically would like to have their fair share, but they really are not interested in having that much of a market that is then subject to some particular catastrophe in a state or anything else. Mm-hmm. Workers' compensation is the first thing on my list. I hesitate to even put it on here for a lot of reasons. Most of you have been here and have seen the trials and tribulations of workers' compensation over the last 4 years. I'm going to start with rates. Much to my chagrin, although I have to say I predicted this and I was right, I'm not pleased to have been right. The most recent study on rankings and premiums around the country, Oregon does a study every 2 years. These are based on 2005 rates, and Alaska took over first place as having the highest average work comp premiums in the country. I don't think that's a distinction that we ever wanted to have, and that's where we are today.
Ms. Hall, yep. Can we get a copy of that, and I'll forward it to the committee members?
Absolutely. We did have this year, effective January 1, a 10% rate average rate decrease, and that means average. I don't know that that would put us in much of any different position. In the Oregon does a study every 2 years, and there's another organization that does a similar study. And the last time they did it, Alaska was number 2, and we were in the top 5 of the other study. So generally, I can sit here and say we have extremely high work comp costs.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair, and Linda. I don't know, maybe Representative Ramos, maybe this has happened differently to him, but and I shared this story a little bit with you earlier, but I'd like to share it with the other committee members. Is a couple of years ago, after we worked on some of the working comps legislation, and 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 3 years ago this spring, I went to there's a small grocery store in my community in Big Lake there, and he has like 28 employees, mostly part-time. He was paying $2,000 every Monday in workman's comp. It's killing him. $130,000 a year. He says, Mark, things don't change. I'm done. I just can't do this. After we did that legislation, I went back to him. Actually, it was 2 years ago. This spring, I went to him. I says, Steve, you know, how are things working for you? And he said, you know, Mark, he says, I don't know what you did, but just yesterday he had signed his contract, yesterday meeting and the day before I had talked to him. He says, you know, my insurance, I had 3 companies brokering for my business now. And before I couldn't get in, he says, but now I had 3, and my rates, and they were right down to the last hour before I had to make a decision. My rates went down to $80,000. Saved him over $50,000. And he was going to close his business down because of that. But now he's in business. 28 people are employed. Was there any specific things that changed there? Or why did this happen, do you think?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I think there are a lot of factors. That amount of decrease astonishes me. I've not seen anything that is that substantial. Well, I've heard a couple stories.
Well, that's a true story.
Several things, I think, have occurred. Are they the result of that legislation? I would like to think some of them are. We are seeing a decrease in frequency. The predominant cause of the reduction in rates this year is a decrease in frequency, which means how often do accidents occur. Accidents in Alaska are still probably significantly higher. The average cost of a claim is significantly higher than the national average. But our frequency is going down, and that is one of the factors that affects cost. Is there competition? I'd like to think there's some. I don't think there's enough to cause that. But I do think we have companies who are looking at a change in environment, whether it's some changes in our comp system, although I would say to you, I don't think it's enough, but we all know what that means. I think we need more, but I think we are starting to see an awareness that Alaska is a place to do business. I'd like to think that we've made enough changes to attract markets here, and we are seeing companies. I've got 2 companies that have filed to do business here in the last 3 months that want to write work comp. Do they want to write significant amounts? No. But they're at least interested in testing waters. I have a couple that have expanded what they're doing. So I'm seeing a little bit of movement in the marketplace. I think we have companies that are looking, and the situation you described may be a program business where they write grocery stores around the country. So they have a different take on that kind of business, and they can do more targeted safety programs, and they can help employers create a safer work environment. That's really a cause. Individual proprietors, such as you describe, also have their own experience factor. If they have higher than the average number of claims, their policies are surcharged. If they have fewer than the expected claims, they get credited for that. So there are lots of things that affect premium.
Yeah, and I know that the Safety in the Workplace program that he's implemented, several of those help in a reduction in his rates. And I'm really curious, maybe if we could get a comment from Representative Rammus, has got, you know, several different types of businesses.
Representative Rammus, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair.
On your take on that, I'm interested.
I will ask a couple of questions and share a couple of things with you. We're part of a CHAR program, the Cabaret and Hotel Restaurant Association. It does more than just lobby for gambling. not much more, but they do have a group work comp program, and we enjoyed a 20. We're going to enjoy a $26,000 refund this year, a rebate on our policy for whatever year that audit is over. We did see a significant rate decrease, but we also had some severe accidents that drove our work our experience modification rate up to 1.20. So we saw rate reductions. And now we're paying a 20% premium on that rate because of accidents we had in the workplace. We had a $300,000 accident where a guy fell on a comb and broke his femur, and extenuating circumstances don't matter. And that's you know, one of the rough things with workers' comp. But that CHAR program is very successful, where they've gathered together a lot of hospitality concepts. Madam Director, I would like to say for the record and for the benefit of your division, we had a situation last year. A constituent came to us. Their business is in our district. They don't live in our district. They were improperly improperly categorized. And the director, and Emily, you're nodding your head because I think that you help with this. But the director took charge of that, got them re-rated. Out of being a contractor and into being housekeepers, because it was a Mary Maids cleaning service. Thank you. And it was a dozen people. A lot of them were vulnerable members of the workforce, single moms who could work during the daytime when their kids weren't in school. They were going broke because of their incorrect rating. Not only did you get them reclassified, but they also qualified for a refund. And had their saw their rates reduced by two-thirds, and saw and had the ability to go back and audit previous years, and that was from the assistance of the people in the Division of Insurance who straightened out that problem. So, great kudos to your department for being proactive and for fixing people's lives and saving jobs and exactly what you're talking about, Representative Newman. And I was really impressed, and they just saw me. Came to see me a month ago, and they're delighted. Thirdly, the question I wanted to ask you relative to this schedule that you just told us about Alaska's work comp rates being the highest, that would suggest that the reverse should be true. And so that's the question I want to frame for you. Does that mean that we take better care, the best care in the country, of our injured workforce, or is something being lost in between? Because presumably, if we're the highest place to do business for work comp, then we ought to also be number one in taking the best care of our injured workers. And if we're not, then that's very indicative that we have a broken program. Otherwise, maybe we just have a system that favors injured workers.
Representative Rammers, I would never say that we take the best care of our injured workers. I don't necessarily think that's true. I think we have different states have different benefit systems. Whether the payments for lost wages differ, and they do significantly. I can give you an example. I just read in a trade journal today, in New York, who also has very high workers' compensation rates, and their average weekly wage payments are among the lowest in the country. So their two are not necessarily correlated. The system looks at the cost of providing medical care and various kinds of benefits for partial or permanent impairments. I don't think Alaska workers are necessarily overly treated. I can't put my fingers on. I know things that I think would help the system, but I don't think that the current system as it is necessarily skewed in one way or the other. I don't think it works very well. I think it's slow. I think some of the reform legislation that was passed has helped that. I think we now have some different things occurring, but I think there's a long way to go. So I don't think because we have the highest premiums means we have the very best system.
Ms. Hall, if you have a spare copy of the most recent NAIC Alaska report, I could forward it to any committee member that wants it. It's
probably the NCCI?
NCCI, yeah.
Yeah, I can do that.
I think it's probably 6 months old.
The forum report?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can certainly provide
thanks.
Any of those that want that. I'm trying to make notes now so I don't forget. I'd be happy to do that.
And that was primarily on workers' compensation. I think that's the only thing it addresses. Representative Ledoux, would you have any comments?
A question. What is the feedback that you've received on that new workers' compensation court?
I had a conversation about a month ago with the, and I don't know even what we call them, the chief judge of that court, for lack of a better term. And they're very pleased. And as I understand it, I've not heard any negative feedback on the court. And only two of their decisions have been appealed to the Supreme Court. That was a major concern when that legislation was passed, that every case that went before that court would then in turn be appealed to the Supreme Court, and that has not happened. There have only been two cases actually appealed to the Supreme Court, which would indicate to me that there's fairly good acceptance of what's occurring there, that neither management nor the unions have appealed those decisions. So I would think that it's working fairly well. That is certainly the feedback I'm getting.
The unions, do you mean the individual claimants?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes. Employee and employer. How's that? Is that better? Sorry. One last thing about work comp rates. I think it was fairly well publicized that the rate decrease as of January 1 of this year was 10%. I will make sure you understand that is an average. And we have rates that went up and rates that went down depending upon various categories. We have some who went down significantly in areas that really do affect Alaska employers. Laundries, dry cleaning went down 31.8%. Florist stores and drivers, 19%. Clerical office employees went down 17%. College professional employees went down 34%. Outdoor guide services went down 33%. So we had some significant decreases. We also had some increases. Landscape gardening went up 15.9%. Iron and steel erection, 16%. Hospital employees, 14.9%. So that 10%, while it's an average, when you get into the individual classifications, there are variations.
Representative Gatto?
Thank you. How does that compare with the previous year? I guess that was an increase, and then this is a 10% decrease?
2006, January 1, was a 7% increase. 2005 was a 12% increase. And are you going to make me say out loud what 2004 was?
Higher.
The 21% increase.
So we
have been going down declining. Consistently. We have been declining, and I think this year was a good step. I don't want there to be unrealistic expectations that a decrease continues, because that's based every year. It's really based on the cost of the system, the cost of claims, and those are very significant. Someone came into our office, wanted to see the rate filing that NCCI did, and it's literally in two binders, so it's like this big. Of various scenarios, various actuarial analysis. It's the only rate filing for which we have public hearings. And in reality, there's very little participation in those public hearings. This year we had an individual speak, so we have had some. It's grown a little bit. But we allow a full day for hearings on that work comp filing, and I'd actually like to see more participation in that.
Follow-up?
Home builders, do we have a rate up or down on home builders?
I don't have that one here. I just picked some at each end.
Yeah, okay.
But the home builders have a variety of different individual classifications. You will get into carpenters and some into cement lane
plumbers
and plumbing, various kinds of things. And I haven't actually looked at those, but I can certainly provide that to you also.
I'm curious about that because that's where the, you know, you're killing me type of statements are coming from. That how much are we adding to the price of a home just to satisfy workman's comp?
I'd be happy to put those together and provide those also so the committee can look at those. The last comment I would make about workers' compensation, which also is indicative of our marketplace, we have what's called a residual market. It's a pool. It's the assigned risk pool. Because it's a mandatory coverage work comp, you have to have coverage. We have a place where if you can't get coverage through any voluntary company, then you can get coverage in the high risk pool. 3 years ago, 20% of the policies in Alaska were in that high-risk pool. We're down to 15%. So we are seeing more writings in our voluntary traditional market and out of the assigned risk pool, which I think is a very good sign.
Now, a portion of that is due to the size of the premium, too, isn't it?
We do it both ways. Yes, a good portion. Probably 85% of the policies that are in the assigned risk pool are under $10,000 in premium.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair. Linda, we hear a lot from the Home Builders Association, and I know quite a few of these gentlemen, their actual experience of where they used to have 50 employees in a company, a construction company. What they've had to do because of workman compensation costs is make each of their employees go out and get their own business license. You know, contractors are specially licensed on top of that, which is an additional expense onto them. And they're down to just like one or two full-time employees, and all their normal employees that they had, you know, a lot of them still work, but they all have to have their own business license doing that. Is that a trend that we expect to see or continue, or how do we reverse that?
Probably as long as workers' compensation is as high as it is, I think it will likely continue. Someplace it's getting paid, whether you have the individual general contractor paying it all, or you have what now have become subcontractors, independent sole proprietors paying it. I mean, the rates aren't different whether you're in a large company. You still have the same rate for the same job, so the size really doesn't matter. I mean, I guess I would say in my mind that's cost shifting. I won't go any farther than that. Quickly, health insurance. We touched on that a little earlier. We have very few markets that write health insurance in the state. We do have a brand new company that started in September who's built up a network. It's called ODS, domiciled in Oregon. It's come in writing individual and group business, so it's a brand new company for us. I think that's a nice sign to me to see somebody willing to come in and write business. Cost is certainly still an issue in health insurance. Same cost drivers in work comp and health insurance, the cost of medical care. And as long as those costs are where they are, we have those cost drivers that drive the rate of insurance.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If indeed I hire a licensed, bonded individual with an employee, and the employee gets hurt, and I discovered that he really wasn't licensed and bonded, who foots the bills for the injured employee?
You.
That's what I thought.
Under Alaska statute, you as the general contractor would be responsible for the employees of a subcontractor. I would certainly hope that if, as a general contractor, you would ask for certificates of insurance from your subs so that you are sure that they do actually have those coverages to
Representative
protect
Ramos.
Yourself.
Thank you. Madam Director, I have an out-of-the-box question for you. It's okay. It's the AML is putting out a theory that I'll get back to your field in a moment. They're putting out a theory that if you serve on the City Council of Dillingham for 6 years and you join PERS as a Tier 1 or Tier 2, and then you go on to become a school teacher in Palmer for 5 years, and you contribute to TERS, and then you wind up your career working at the University of Alaska, and you become vested, and you become a burden to the state's PERS-TERS system, they're saying that that burden reverts back to Dillingham, the first employer. And as such, they want the state to absorb a significant part of the PERS-TERS burden. It's the AML theory that's going around right now. Would you briefly talk to us about how work comp works if you're a carpenter? You start being a carpenter at age 20, and you finish being a carpenter at age 55 with a workers' comp career-ending injury, and that happens on the watch of your fifth employer over that 30 or 35-year work history. Whose responsibility is it to care for that injured worker? The first, second, third, fourth, or the final employer?
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, I can't possibly answer the question. That is a fact-specific case. There's been a tremendous amount of litigation. Typically, you're looking at the major contributing factor. So something that happened to you at age 20, which probably had no impact, when it happens to us at age 50 plus, has a much greater impact. That does not typically go all the way back to that original injury. In some cases where you may have gone through a rehabilitation, there may be other kinds of contributing factors there, and it may get shared. But without specific data, I really can't answer that, nor do I really want to. Okay. And the last point I made about health insurance, I do want to make sure you realize that we only actually have primary oversight over about 40% of the insured individuals in Alaska. The reason I bring that up is because you will frequently see bills that mandate benefits. And when we mandate benefits, that same mandate is only going to affect that 40%. So we're mandating something for 40% that those plans that are self-insured, regulated under ERISA, do not have to follow. And sometimes that's a misunderstanding. So I just kind of want to make that point. A last market thing I would talk about are homeowners and earthquake. I would guess most of you have heard, as we have heard, there is a shortage of earthquake coverage in Alaska. And I will say we have a brand new market that is not affiliated with any of the current writers who is writing earthquakes, so there are other markets. But we don't have a lot of homeowners markets either. We have some. We have a couple that have very large market shares. They're not interested in having a lot more. So having a new homeowners market is something that's a major priority for me. I think I'm fairly close to having one, but until I really see them make a filing, I won't hold my breath. But I just really wanted to say to you, as we've had some major national publicity about one particular company pulling out of the earthquake market nationally, not just in Alaska, we do have a replacement company to write earthquake coverage. Solvency issues, and this will go
Representative
into...
Representative Gatto?
I'm sorry.
Just getting back to earthquakes. Mm-hmm. If a company comes in to insure homes against earthquakes, and we have one homeowner that lives in Palmer on a moraine, 500 feet of gravel, and the second homeowner lives in Earthquake Park in Anchorage, are the rates different even though the homes are valued at the same amount?
I don't know for sure. I think there are earthquake zones that may have a different rate, but I'm not sure.
Representative Booth?
Thank you for coming here today, and I appreciate it. Thank you. Through the chair, on some of your homeowners insurance, is it specific that you're aware of? Part of some of the things that I've seen happen since I've lived here is that it's specific. In other words, if a person is building a log home, as an example, that may or may not be in an area where you have inspectors, they have a difficult time getting insurance for that home. Do you have any knowledge specific to that?
Through the chair, Representative Book, I have some, not in the role that I have today, but when I was actually in the industry. Mm-hmm. And there are companies that have different underwriting guidelines of what they're willing to write. And they may not be willing to write in some of the areas that are more remote in Alaska in the first place. And some will have those structural kinds of prohibitions. So not all of them are willing to write that. I think there are companies that will write those, but there will be a price for that, too.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think that goes down to bushfires are typically total losses. Mm-hmm. So you're insuring to full value rather than expecting a partial loss every now and then.
The next topic that I had put on my list, and I've been talking an awfully long time, so if you're bored, you know,
are you whatever. Have 45 more minutes.
How many?
45.
Oh, goodness. Well, I can talk that long, but I'm not sure you want to hear me that long. Solvency. I want to take an opportunity to talk about how important I think solvency oversight is. I think it's the primary function of the Division of Insurance. All the other things are equally important, but this is the bottom line. Unless we know that insurance company is solvent, that there will be money there to pay claims, we don't have anything. You referenced Representative Ramros earlier today, the crisis we had in late 2003. I think many of you were here and heard me talk about the crisis. We had a major work comp writer become insolvent. And insolvency was caused probably not by any particular single thing, but under reserving of claims. One of the things that occurs in financial exams is we look at reserving practices. If you have claims, how accurately are you reserving? And those reserves change. We had a company who had no longer writing Alaska, had not for 2 years, but in July of 2003, they were declared insolvent. When they were actively writing, they wrote about 30% of our work comp market.
And that would be Industrial or Fremont?
That would be Fremont. The year before, we had another large carrier, Reliance, who had become insolvent. There is set up by statute a guarantee association. There's a life and health guarantee association. There's a property casualty guarantee association. These are safety nets. It's a safety net for an insurance company insolvency. In my tenure in insurance in Alaska, which had been 20-plus years, I don't think any of us had ever thought the safety net would fail. That's why you have safety nets. In the fall, when this company became insolvent, we already had four insolvent work comp writers. They were much smaller. But then when we had this very large insolvency, what we had was a catastrophe with our guarantee fund. The guarantee fund does not pre-assess. It's called a post-loss assessment. Their ability to assess by statute was 2% of the premium. That assessment is made on insurance companies. And the assessment ultimately is passed on to the policyholder, as those of you who are in business and paid that know. Representative Ramros and I have had lots of conversations about those. What we had at that time was about a ability to generate $4 million in revenue through assessments to a guarantee fund who had been given the claims of all of the insolvent insurers as the safety net. They stand in the place of the insurance company. They were paying claims at the rate of about $1 million a month. So we've got about $12 million worth of liabilities facing the next year and the ability to generate $4 million in revenue. Obviously, it was a crisis. What happens when the guarantee fund can't pay either, the responsibility for that work comp loss goes back to the employer. We had in excess of 800 injured workers who had claims in the guarantee fund, over 400 employers who were affected by this. So no single employer had a lot of claims, but I will tell you there was one claim reserved in excess of $5 million. There were half a dozen of $1 million or more. There were over 100 that were over $100,000. If you think about the people you know in business, I don't know any of them that can afford to foot that kind of a bill. plus they don't even know they're going to be on the hook for this kind of a bill. Through a lot of work, a lot of legislative work, a lot of time and effort, we put together a plan. We increased the assessments to the Guarantee Association up to 4%, and in the process, we're able to continue to pay claims to the point that I'm really pleased to give you an update on that. As of January 1 of this year, there is no assessment. It doesn't mean there's adequate pot of money to pay all the reserve claims for the next 10 years. Work comp claims go on for a long time. But there is adequate money that the Guarantee Association Board felt there was adequate funding based on their actuarial analysis of the reserves that they did not do an assessment this year. So I will say the solution worked. We didn't have an injured worker that didn't get paid. We didn't have an employer who had to take over that obligation. But it was, I think, a real eye-opener to all of us involved in that situation, particularly me. It was my first year here. I was not excited. In that process, we talked about a lot of things, and the things that happen, what can we do, what is the best way to resolve that situation. And that solution sunsets in 6 years. We're 3 years into that, so it's not for a while. But it also pointed out to us what we need to look at, and I think it also emphasized the importance of financial solvency, because we were close to having a disaster. Representative Ramirez, I'm going to try. You made a comment to me. You had a question. Do you want to ask it? Want me to talk about it? What would you like me to do?
Through the chair, you're doing great.
You just want me to just keep on jabbing?
I don't remember the question.
You asked.
It was a good question.
It was a good question.
I don't recollect what, but I'd be happy to re-ask it. But just tell me what the nature
okay.
of the question.
At any rate, I wanted an opportunity to point out a near catastrophe that occurred. The solution worked. Today we do not have surcharges. That doesn't mean a couple years down the road. We could always have another insolvency. We could always have the claims become higher. We're down now to paying about $5 million a year. So the claims, some of them, people get better. They go back to work. So the amount of payout has gotten less. The guarantee fund does have money. They don't have enough, as I said. So they're probably, if you took the potential liability to its extreme, they'd probably still be $10 or $15 million in the hole. The chances of that happening with nothing changing from today are not very great, but it is still a possibility. But that 4%, we increased the surcharge from 2% to 4%. And that, again, contributed to the high cost of work comp. We've added another 4%. And with our premiums, that really is a burden. Different states have different ways of doing that. Alaska is a direct. The insurance company pays that assessment up front. They get it back over time. Some states, the state funds more of that through a premium tax offset. So there are other ways of actually funding that. But again, when I talk, and you will probably hear me sometime this year in here talking about solvency, these are the reasons that I feel so strongly about solvency and financial oversight. Even with the kind of oversight we do, insolvencies happen. Businesses go out of business. So it was an opportunity for me to present that to you.
Representative Newman and then Representative Ramirez.
Linda, I find this fascinating what we're talking about, because I think insurance, again, you know, workman's comp has so much to do with business and what's going on. Could you explain to me a little bit about what happens when an employee gets injured? Maybe somebody slips on a comb and breaks their femur or something like that and files a workman's comp claim. What happens when that happens? Can you explain what mechanisms are in place? What happens then?
The first step, one, I will put some disclaimer in what I'm going to talk about. I don't handle the work comp system. I handle the insurance piece. Through the last 4 years of working on work comp, I've learned a lot about the system. But using your example, in the best possible case, and it doesn't always work this way, But that employee who's injured would notify his employer that he has been injured on the job. The employer report...
Within a certain time limit?
Yes, there are time limits, although they're actually, I think, like 2 years. But hopefully, if they're injured, they will report it very quickly. The more quickly it's reported and dealt with, usually, the faster the employee gets treatment, the faster they get treatment, the faster they get back to work and all of those things. But reports the claim, I was injured, this is what happened. There will be some kind of maybe internal investigation, but within a certain time frame, and frankly I can't tell you, the employer is obligated to report that injury to the insurance company and to the Department of Labor. There's a standard report of injury form that needs to be filled out, and that's what actually sets in motion the claims. The insurance company will investigate or look, and at that point, they take over in the stead of the employer, because the actual responsibility for the payment of the injury is the employer's. They satisfy that responsibility with the purchase of work comp insurance or by being a qualified self-insurer. But at that point, the insurance company becomes involved. They have claims people who specialize in workers' compensation, and they start to, one, pay, and there are time limits in which they pay lost wages. There are time limits where they pay medical bills. If there's a dispute about did it happen on the job, is this a legitimate bill, those kinds of things then will be, it's called, they will go to the Workers' Compensation Board for kind of an impartial hearing between the injured worker and the employer. That's sometimes where things slow down, where they become a problem. But very small portion of claims actually go to that degree. Normally, in a normal run-of-the-mill work comp claim, claim goes to the insurance company. The insurance company pays the lost wages according to a certain schedule, and they pay the medical bills as they arise and things. One, there must be, I think, as I've heard Director Lasanke testify, 20,000 work comp claims a year. And it's a very small number that actually get into some kind of dispute process. Those that do are the ones we tend to hear about. They're ugly.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Ramirez and then Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to overwhelm you with praise, but...
oh, please do.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Well, it seems to me that the nature of the system is employers aren't allowed to self-insure, so we have to have workers' comp, and we pay into it, and then if there's a work-related injury, then our comp insurance kicks in and pays. And the risk that we all ran with the Fremont episode was that burden was going to be returned to the employer. So that I went without insurance coverage and without a guarantee fund, all of that exposure would have returned to the employer as it related to any outstanding claims that we would have had. And so I was talking to Representative Book while you were talking, sorry. And, you know, her friend, Director Bannock, that runs the DMV, I don't know how somebody in public service gets so excited about running the Department of Motor Vehicles, but he manages to do it, and I'm just in awe of how entrepreneurial he is about what for some of us might be dry subject matter. And Director, you saved the work comp system in Alaska. I mean, you fixed it. I wasn't happy about paying that 2% or that 4%, but I mean, you did an exceptional job, and it's unheralded because work comp is not highly regarded as like plumbing, or, you know, around the state. But without it, we'd all be in trouble. And so the work that you did over the last 3 or 4 years to resurrect and to hold up and fix the comp system, because I believe that there are credits that can be given out on comp. Also, that rates are established, but it's a competitive market. So when Fremont came in and lowballed the market, other comp carriers had to come in and compete for the business that Fremont was taking. So as a result, other comp carriers didn't make any money in the market by trying to be competitive with Fremont. Isn't that, is that correct, or did?
That's correct.
What was the Fremont?
Fremont was just the name of a company that came in, and they just lowballed the market. And I remember a couple of years when I had Fremont, and I was just, I mean, talk about your grocer friend. I was like, I can't believe my rates went this low. And like the old cliche about, you know, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. The rates that Fremont offered were too good to be true. Other insurance companies matched it for a number of years. There was no money to be made. Fremont failed, and so every bit of savings that we realized as employers, we gave back in subsequent years to significant rate increases as well as paying into the guarantee fund. But the fact that remains is that you and your stewardship of the Division of Insurance saved our system from going off the cliff. And it's really, it's not a very well-told story, but here in this committee room, just a few people, you should get a great deal of credit for that. Job well done.
Make him cry.
Representative Booth?
No, I'm not going to cry. I remember crying over that. No,
well,
I very much appreciate the comment.
Legislative citation.
It was a legislative effort by a number of people, and there were a number of people who supported me. And I frankly have to tell you, probably the most exciting piece was the day it was on the floor in the House, and it was a 40-0 vote. And that was extremely pleasing to me to see that. But thank you. I certainly can't take credit for that by myself. But
and here I am, the new guy, about to put a wet blanket on this party.
That's okay.
As somebody
who is
reticent about this, I mean, we have 1 year where we can look at a trend, you know, and hopefully this will be reoccurring. Whether it's an anomaly or not, we're all here to judge, right? So in looking at the disputes that you talked about, we went from a different system in the past that seemed to be fairly equitable to a system now where I have some questions. But I am going to hold those comments, and we're going to see how this all works out. I think that we have made some changes here, and I think they're probably worthy of careful consideration. So I'm excited to see that we have made some turns in this and that maybe the correct directions have been taken, although I am a little bit more careful about this is going to look like in 2008 or 9 or 10. So this is exciting, and I'm glad to see a start here and given some breaks to those people who really had at great risk for a period of about a year where their businesses were put on the line. It's exciting to see that hat has been covered. So
I
hate to be realistic news, but that's the way that I look at it.
I think your reservations are well-founded. I have those same reservations. I would like to think there are some things that are changing, but Britt.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Interestingly, it wasn't just private entrepreneurs that suffered. The school district said, Fremont, lower price, count me in. And they were in lock, stock, and barrel when the failure occurred. And so they also had a situation that they had to make up in their communities. And the larger the school district, the more the amount of dollars it was. So it was a across the board, private enterprise and government both, that took a beating. And I don't know what we've learned. Are we able to evaluate a great deal, or do we read the post office sign and say, hey, when it's too good to be true, be careful?
I hope we've learned that. I think at the division, we learned some things. I think everybody did. The industry who today, and now I'm talking about the sales force, the agents that sell coverage, have really taken a different stance at looking. I don't see people clamoring to sell something just on price. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of things that were there that it was a huge wake-up call. And
follow.
Yeah, just to continue a little bit, if a company comes in and offers a deal is there anything as the director that you can do besides, is there an investigatory procedure that says you can't charge that little?
Yes.
Okay. So you can prevent a company from operating in the state if you believe they're underfunded.
We could prevent them from operating in the state if we think they're underfunded. I mentioned earlier our market conduct section. We actually had some allegations a couple years ago of a company coming in and doing something very similar to what Fremont had done. And we did what we call a targeted market conduct examination, went in and reviewed every file, every underwriting file, to look at the way they were rating their business and if they were following their filed schedule rating plans. Because we're very concerned about ever having a repeat of that. So we're very careful about doing that.
Linda, at the risk of alienating a good friend of, 20 years and putting probably half the people in the room asleep, could you give us about a two-minute comparison of the difference between having an insolvency against a company that's domiciled in Alaska as opposed to being admitted in Alaska, specifically on workers' comp? Because I think that'll probably shed some light on the problems that you had with Fremont.
Well, if it's a company that's domiciled in Alaska, mm-hmm. And have I lost most of the audience already?
The slow
No, we're all in.
I promised Eleanor I would not bore you till your eyes glazed over.
I can get blamed for this one.
When it's our domestic company, we do a great deal more scrutiny, and we look at their practices, and we are not the primary regulator of a company that's headquartered in California, for example, or any place else. We rely on that particular state's regulatory agency to do appropriate oversight. And I hope and I feel fairly comfortable that we do enough oversight. And I think those companies that are domiciled here feel that way also. I mean, we spar periodically over what we want them to do. And so I'd like to think we have more control if it's a company that does business here, that they're domiciled here.
And we're both the assets and the ability to move faster.
Correct. It is. And I think we have a couple very excellent companies that are domiciled here that write work comp, one large, one small.
But in this particular case, Fremont was domiciled in California, and
that's
we
correct.
Were not at the top of the food chain on getting money out of the...
They've actually, since they became insolvent, they have been very good. They actually, it's one of the ways the guarantee fund had money to operate. We had loans both from Pennsylvania and from California from the liquidators. Those have been paid back through as they do what are called disbursements. As there's money in those estates and the liquidator's comfortable, they do early access distributions. And California loaned the guarantee fund $5 million. And that has been paid back through, we just didn't take the distributions that had, they charged it against that. But that's how the guarantee fund had money to operate that first year, were through loans made by California and Pennsylvania.
Representative Ledoux.
Does the division have any authority to make an insurance company post a bond to guarantee their solvency?
No.
Is that something that if you did have the authority to do, that you would?
I'd have to think about it. There have been different proposals made to post larger deposits in the state, and there are pros and cons to that. I've had those discussions during this time, particularly with our chief financial examiner and what other states do. And whether or not they could get a bond that would do that kind of thing, it wouldn't be common. It's something I'd have to think about to see what pros and cons there were. I wouldn't want to commit to that one way or the other.
Follow up?
Certainly.
So you don't know of any states that do require such
no,
a bond?
No, I do not.
Thank you.
I will quickly try to, have I really now? I really.
Oh, no, we're not going to get off without talking about credit scoring.
I'm not ready. I'm not done yet. I don't want to talk about credit scoring. One topic that I won't spend more than 1 minute on, the regulatory modernization. These are efforts that we have made nationally and in our state to make this a easier place to do business. Interstate Compact was legislation passed last year to allow life insurance companies to make filings in a centralized location. 29 states now participate in that. It's just starting to get functional. We did some file and use types of forms. We have internally an IT project to help make doing business with the Division of Insurance more streamlined. We now do electronic licensing for agents and brokers. So there are things that we're trying to do to make Alaska an easier place to do business in. The last thing I would like to touch on very briefly are regulatory issues. The types of things we see every day and the things that we're involved in today, you may have read, and we read periodically, I think there was a Dateline 20 Minutes indication on annuities. Last year we passed some legislation, you passed some legislation, we proposed it, to limit the surrender charges on annuities that are sold to seniors so that we don't have seniors having to pay surrender charges until they're 100. We are currently drafting suitability regulations so that products being sold, annuities being sold, actually have to have some analysis of whether they're suitable for the individual buying them. So we really try to look at what's occurring in our marketplace and respond to that. Those are some of the kinds of regulatory issues we get involved in. Disciplinary issues that we face on a daily basis. Major one is unlicensed activity. We find entities doing business in Alaska that are unlicensed. May be an agent, it may be a more intermediary. When we find that, we actually have, generally we don't even have to go to hearing. We propose a stipulated agreement which will say, you know, you owe us X amount of money for a fine, and if you do this again, and we will waive a piece of that, and if you do this again ever, you have to pay it all to us and we will probably revoke your license. We also do actually revoke licenses. I'm going to give you an example of one we just did. And I actually asked our criminal prosecutor if it was inappropriate to be as excited about a license revocation as I was. We had an adjusting company that we had started to have complaints about, and this is why I encourage you to have constituents let us know. We started to have complaints about an adjusting company. Then we had a complaint from the Division of Work Comp, the Work Comp Board, about the company. And we did one of the market conducts. It's the kind of thing we do. We went out and went through this individual's files, sampled 51 files, found 119 violations of Alaska statute in 37 of those files. And today the individual's license has been revoked and we'll never be able to do business again. And by revoking, we also are reporting that to a national database. So in theory, the individual should never be able to have a license to be a work comp adjuster again. I mean, those are the kinds of things we do. They're very serious. I mean, that's a very serious penalty. But it's one that I felt was more than warranted when we found the number of violations that we found. But that's the outcome of things that start here with complaints, and they can go to that extreme. We also are involved in a number of multi-state investigations. Today, Alaska is a co-lead with Washington on an investigation into a very large life insurance company. That will be coming to an end very soon. Reports and various fines and other rehabilitative measures will result. We did one against a brokerage firm about 2 years ago where restitution was paid. We joined with three other East Coast states and won a disability company, which resulted in claims being reopened for about 25 Alaskans who had their disability claims denied. So these are all kinds of things that we do in the Division of Insurance. And with that, I'll stop. And if you make me talk about credit scoring, what do you want me to talk about?
I'll let you off the hook.
You'll let me off the hook? I mean, I've talked for 2 hours nonstop. How much did you want to hear? I don't have an update on credit scoring, actually. I can't remember when we've had a complaint about it. It's certainly a controversial topic. We have probably one of the more stringent credit scoring statutes in the country. When we passed it, we knew that. We put places that we had seen abuses around the country. We put prohibitions in. Frankly, we are before the Supreme Court today. We had oral arguments in early January over a credit scoring interpretation by the division. And so where we are even internally in the state is somewhat up for grabs until we get the decision from the Supreme Court.
Are there any further questions for Ms. Hall?
Yeah, I'm not sure I know what credit scoring is.
Credit scoring, show her your book again. Credit scoring is the use of, as one of the factors that's taken into account in coming up with an insurance rate. Actuarially, over a number of years, there's been shown to be a correlation between a credit score and whether or not you have insurance claims. And we've seen half a dozen studies around the country that have shown that correlation. Does it make any logical sense? Probably not.
In other words, if your credit score indicates that you're a deadbeat, that you're more likely to run a business that's going to have accidents, is that kind
you're
of
more likely to have insurance claims.
You're more likely to have an insurance claim. On the other hand, if you have a really high credit score and a really bad driving record, you still will have a better insurance premium. That's what it is, in a nutshell.
The problem is they can't figure out how it works, but it does. And that apparently raises some issues of potential for discrimination. There's absolutely no logic to why it works, but it does.
Credit scoring does work?
Yeah.
Actuarially, yes. From the number of studies that have been done around the country, that correlation has been there. But there certainly are concerns about it.
So are people allowed to do it?
Yes.
There are limits on it.
Yes, there are definitely limits.
More limits than there used to be.
It's happened for a long time. This is not really something new, and the legislation is 4 years old.
So. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doesn't every insurance company score? If I bring my 17-year-old son, they're scoring big time and saying, you want to buy insurance? Be happy to sell you insurance. I bring my wife, mother. Oh, she gets a serious break in insurance. Isn't that credit scoring?
No. Those are age is a factor that is used in underwriting. How far you drive to work is a factor. The kind of car you drive certainly has an impact. Where you live has an impact. Auto insurance rates are less expensive in Palmer than they are in Anchorage. Fewer cars, in theory, fewer accidents. So there are lots of factors. And your credit score is reflective of, there are, again, a multitude of components, but basically it's your bill paying history. So
is this the thing they advertise on TV? What's your credit score?
Yeah, it's the same thing.
700 is a good number.
Those are usually for home loans. They don't use the same kind of formula.
Yeah.
But it's a similar kind of thing, yes.
I got a meeting.
Any other questions for Ms. Hall? Thank you again. Enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me here. I hope you weren't totally bored.
Nope. I didn't see anybody fall asleep. And with that, we'll adjourn at 10 minutes to 5.